Jasmin Little is a versatile concert soloist, a recitalist, a chamber musician, and even as a scholar and television producer, she has proved that her interests know few boundaries. So I'm delighted to welcome to Ten Radio Tasmin. Good morning to you, Tasmin.
Good morning.
And thank you so much for agreeing to come and speak with us. Perhaps we could start with a little bit of kind of what were your earliest childhood memories, and how did you, you know, what sort of age did you know or feel this is the life for me?
Well, my earliest childhood memories are of growing up in a household full of music. My father's profession was an actor, and he was frequently in musicals throughout my childhood, some of them very famous, such as Oliver and Fiddler on the Roof, and some of them slightly less famous. But there was a lot of music that was on in the house, both my father's singing and also my parents' love of classical music, as well as other kinds of music. So it certainly was a very vibrant and musical background that I grew up in. However, neither of my parents was musicians. They were just, you know, really music lovers. And music was a big, big part of the family life.
Excellent. And so when did you start playing? And I mean, did you start on the violin, or was it just, oh, you know, like kids do, oh, have piano lessons, or how did it start?
Well, it started rather sadly with my getting ill with chickenpox, and I was very bored in bed, and I was never really one for watching television. I preferred to do things. So after nagging my mother and making her very cross with me because I was bored, I asked her if she'd please buy me a recorder, and so she did, and a book, and I whiled away a very pleasant half an hour teaching myself to play the recorder and to read music. And my mother was very surprised when I said that I'd finished the book and wanted the next one, please. And so I really enjoyed and found it very easy to play the recorder and to read music. So when I was better and I went back to school again, I decided that I wanted to play the piano, and also I wanted to try the violin. I began piano before the violin, but only just, because the violin wasn't supposed to be taught to anybody that was under eight, and I was six, nearly seven. So I wasn't allowed lessons at the school. However, because I'd made very good progress, my mother spoke to the violin teacher, and he agreed to give me an ear test. And he was very excited when he found out that I'd got perfect pitch. And then he was wonderful and moved all sorts of mountains in order to create a special 15-minute slot for me a week where I could learn the violin, and I made very, very quick progress, but sort of knew really as soon as I started to play the violin that this was my instrument and that this is how I wanted to spend the rest of my life.
That's interesting. I mean, you mentioned that you were brought up in Northwest London.
Yes, that's right. I grew up in Northwest London, although neither of my parents is actually from London. My father is from Bradford in Yorkshire, and my mum was born in Stratford-upon-Avon, and so they moved to London when they got married.
Could I ask which part of London?
Yes, we grew up in West Hampstead.
Oh, same here.
Oh, right. Very nice. I went to New End Primary School in Hampstead, which was a wonderful school, and in those days, in the 70s, there were full-time music teachers there, so there was a full-time violin teacher. It's unthinkable now. But I was terribly lucky because, you know, if that hadn't have been the case, I don't suppose I would have actually managed to find my way into music as a career.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. I mean, I was round the corner in Christchurch School.
Oh, right. Yes, indeed.
Wonderful musical influence.
Yes. I
think it was in schooling a lot more, wasn't it, at that
yes.
time?
I think it was, and that's been one of
yes.
the main
yes.
drive for me to keep on fighting the fight for music education, because I am well aware that without the circumstances in which I grew up, I very much doubt that I would have had the opportunities that I'd had to forge this career in music.
You alluded to perfect pitch. That can be a nightmare, can't it? I fortunately haven't quite got it, but you know, if I sang something, I think it would be the right note on the piano, but I wouldn't know necessarily which note it was near exactly.
Yes, well, I mean, perfect pitch is, I mean, I've always found it a great help, actually, particularly with memorising certain pieces of music.
Of course.
But it isn't actually necessary, and it isn't a sign of musicality, in my opinion. There are perfectly musical people who don't have perfect pitch. It's more a memory thing, really, that you have a particular kind of oral memory to be able to associate one pitch with a note.
Yes. So you went on, you studied, you know, obviously you had the teacher at school, and then you went on. That took you on to the Yehuda Menuhin School.
I mean, this same very, very wise violin teacher realised that I was very talented and said that what I very much needed was, in fact, a specialist music school in order to maximise my potential. And it was he who suggested that I should audition for the Yehudi Menuhin School. And it was around about March, so I'd actually missed the preliminary audition, but the school were very kind and said that I could do a preliminary one in the morning. And if I was good enough, then I could take the final audition in the afternoon, and that was in front of Yehudi Menuhin. And then, you know, I was quite nervous, really, because I hadn't realised that there were people who would be much older than me and far further ahead than I was. I'd only been learning a year. So obviously I'd made very good progress, but I wasn't playing the same way as 13-year-olds were playing. She didn't really fancy my chances about getting in. But they did pick me, and obviously they picked me on my potential. And so I started at the school when I was just 8 years old, and I stayed for 10 years.
That's marvellous. In fact, am I right, you actually went on and were quite a good friend of Yehudi Menuhin?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. He was such a wonderful man, a very very great man, because he remained extremely humble no matter what he achieved in his life.
Sure.
It was huge. And on an international scale, even politically as well.
Yes.
But he never lost his ability to speak to, you know, people really of all ages, from all sorts of backgrounds.
I gather you've carried that tradition on, but one of the comments I wanted to make was that some of the research that I've done says, you know, you've done the pieces by this composer and that composer. I think it's almost fair to say that, in fact, you could probably write down on a list the composers you haven't done.
I really love the repertoire for violin, and it's one of the things that's fed my continued interest in my work, because I feel that if you confine yourself to a small group of composers or a certain genre, I think that one could end up becoming a little bit stale. But because I play literally everything from Bach to works that were written last week, I've really managed to stay very fresh in even repertoire that is extremely familiar and gets played a great deal. So, I mean, works such as the Bruch First Violin Concerto. You know, if I only had ever really played that alongside another couple of concertos, I think probably I would have lost my real enthusiasm for the piece. But because of all the other things that I do in the meantime, whenever I come back to the Bruch, it's like greeting an old friend, and I feel I fall in love with it all over again.
How lovely. That's absolutely wonderful. So some of your more recent projects, you did an album that came out in November?
Yes, I'm thrilled with this one. It's the Samuel Coleridge Taylor Violin Concerto and the Haydn Wood Violin Concerto. They're beautiful pieces. They're so romantic, particularly the Coleridge Taylor. I feel it's a sort of cross between Dvorak and Puccini for the violin. It's wonderful, beautiful, soaring melodies and an incredibly intensely romantic second movement. And the Haydn Wood, slightly later, but still immensely tuneful and a beautiful piece. And then a very rarely heard work by Delius, his early suite, which is written at a point in time where he's still sort of full of the joie de vivre of his time in America. And so again, that's very tuneful as well. And the album's received such marvellous praise. It's got 5 stars in the BBC Music Magazine and a wonderful glowing review in the Gramophone magazine as well. So I'm really thrilled with it.
Well, let's take a break and hear the intermezzo by Delius from that album.
Thank you. The Intermezzo from the Suite for Violin and Orchestra by Delius, with Sir Andrew Davis conducting the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, and our guest today, Tasmin Little, on the violin.
So what have you got happening now? What are your latest projects? I have to say that, in fact, one of the local rags said that you were starting your world tour in Taunton. But, of course, it's not you starting your tour. It's the orchestra who you're playing with, the European Union Chamber Orchestra.
That's true, yes, absolutely. But, I mean, I've only really just started again at the beginning of this year. So Taunton is one of my first stops on a journey that will take me all the way to Australia by the summertime. So it's nearly true to say that I'm starting my world tour.
Jolly good.
But projects are coming up very imminently. I'm very excited that I'll be releasing my box set of three discs of the complete Beethoven sonatas for violin and piano, or sonatas for piano and violin, because in fact he put it that way around. And of course they're very, very wonderful and famous works, the most famous of which is the Beethoven Spring Sonata and the Kreutzer Sonata as well. And we're going to play those two works, Martin Roscoe and myself will play those at the Wigmore Hall on the 10th of February to launch this set of discs. And I'm very excited. It's something slightly different. I haven't recorded a great deal of Beethoven's music. I did record the Triple Concerto with Howard Shelley, and I really enjoyed that. And obviously I've played Beethoven for my whole life, but he's not well represented for me on disc, so this box set is going to cover all of that lot now.
Very good. So which label is that on?
I only ever record for Chandos now, and they're wonderfully supportive. And what's nice is that I'm allowed to choose a lot of repertoire, and, you know, we seem to coincide on what's wanted and make suggestions and things. So it's a very happy relationship and one that I'm really thrilled about. And so far, all the CDs that we've made together have been extremely well received. So I feel very, very pleased that, you know, here I am. Sort of, you know, very experienced player now. I'm not young and just starting out, but I feel that I can really be represented well on disc because of this extra special relationship that I've got with Chandos.
Yeah, so it's being released?
It's going to be released literally any moment now. It'll be available in early February.
Oh, right, excellent. We'll keep an eye open for it.
Thank you.
Good. You referred to Delius, and indeed I'm aware of that, and it's a wonderful, wonderful programme in two parts that one can actually see on the internet about the lost child, most fascinating story,
yes.
How you actually found out so much about what happened to Delius. I mean, that must have been a really exciting project.
It was a very exciting project, and actually I can hardly believe it is nearly 20 years since I went to Florida to try to dig around and find some information about this child that was referred to in a letter as being Delius's love child with the quadroon girl Chloe, who lived very near to where Delius lived, near Jacksonville in Florida. And he went there really to escape his very overbearing father, who was a wool merchant and wanted Delius to take over the family business. So Delius couldn't abide that thought. And one of the rather harebrained schemes that he had was to get his father to buy him an orange and grapefruit plantation in Florida with a friend of his, Charles Douglas, to ostensibly grow oranges and grapefruit, except of course he didn't. As soon as he was there, he immersed himself in the life. And, you know, if you can imagine the difference between being in Bradford in the sort of the 1860s, 1870s, early 1880s, and then going to this lush sort of semi-tropical paradise in Florida with, you know, all the former slave workers now working in plantations as free people, but singing the old slave songs and all this African-American music. And it literally just fed his imagination and fired him up incredibly. And he really took a lot of his musical ideas from that period there. So a lot of the harmonic ideas, so the pentatonic scale and what we now refer to as the Scotch snap, which is a rhythmic element in a lot of folk music. So he really encountered a lot there, and then eventually was sort of hauled back to England by his father. By that time, he'd got the bug for music, and there was no way that he was going to enter the family business. And so he sort of went his own way and went to study in Leipzig and then went on to live in France. But, you know, you can really tell that that period in Florida had a massive impact. And one of the things that I believe happened to him was that he met this girl and had a love affair with her, and it resulted in her bearing his child. But he didn't know about that until some years later, when the child would have been about 12. He went back to Florida in around about 1897 to try and find her and the child. But she thought that he'd come to take the child away, and so she ran away with the child, and he never found her, and he never met the child, and he never worked out what happened to them. So I was trying to piece together some of his jigsaw puzzle to see if I could find any information about whether this story was accurate, and if so, where the child was and who the child was.
That must have been, you know, quite sad and poignant thing for him. But obviously, doing that must have obviously did inspire his music.
Exactly. And his music changed markedly after 1897 and developed this sort of haunting quality. And I think that it was as a direct result of this loss that he had suffered. And I don't believe it's any coincidence at all that his style changed so dramatically then. You know, before then he was full of the joys and it was, you know, very optimistic music. And then after that he talks, you know, wrote so many works talking about love lost and lovers parted never to see each other again. And it's just always there. It's a recurring theme in his music.
So presumably, in fact, in making that that lovely thing, The Lost Child, presumably that actually gave you inspiration to his music as well.
It did. It absolutely did. And although we couldn't find anything that was literally irrefutable evidence, it was concrete enough for me. And it just backed up what I'd always felt about his music. But it was very, very interesting to actually be there to see Solana Grove, which was the plantation where he'd had his little house, and just to be sort of immersed in what he would have been immersed in himself, and to see why it was that he fell in love with this place and indeed fell in love with the girl.
Let's play another piece from the Delia Suite, this time the Adagio Cantabile, the Elegy. One can imagine the composer thinking of his lost loves whilst composing this charming piece. The elegy there from Delia's suite for violin and orchestra, played by Tasmin Little on the violin.
Tasmin, I gather that following in the footsteps of somebody else who'd had a go at it, you did a bit of street busking. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a really interesting day, and in fact it ended up being rather an important day for me. I was invited by the Independent newspaper to go and stand under the rather damp and slightly smelly and bird-ridden arches near Waterloo Station in London and do some busking to see whether people were interested in what street musicians did and whether the quality of playing made any difference to whether people took any notice or not. And it was a fascinating experience because the slightly older generation weren't really very interested. They, you know, didn't obviously appreciate being either cold, which I can understand. Nobody really looked at me as they were walking past, but a lot of the younger generation were very interested. And in fact, I remember a couple of young boys, probably about 13 or so, they were so sweet. They stopped and they listened and they were kind of foraging around in their pocket to see what loose change they'd got from presumably their pocket money. And it was so lovely. And I felt really heartened by that young people, you know, do love classical music. They do like listening to classical music, but I think sometimes they can be very off-put by the circumstances, such as, you know, concert halls and things. Maybe people don't feel so comfortable there. So it set me thinking, because I thought it's such a pity if people are put off listening to classical music because they think either that they are supposed to know something about it in advance, or maybe they might clap in the wrong place, or whatever. So it actually was one of the things that led me to conceive my project called The Naked Violin, which was when I recorded three works for solo violin, and I put them up online free of charge for people to download, along with some program notes and some spoken introductions, so that people who'd ever wondered if they might like classical music would have an opportunity at no charge whatsoever and in the comfort of their home to experience it. And the response was just absolutely extraordinary. It was overwhelming. Within a couple of weeks, I had something like 6,500 websites all linked to mine to provide this music. And I had literally hundreds of letters from people all over the world thanking me for the music, very often saying that they were going to go and explore more of classical music. So it really did have an effect far wider reaching than I had anticipated. And that was the first part of the project. And then the next part of the project was to go into the community and take music into prisons and hospitals. And I mean, I've always played a lot in schools, but, you know, obviously continuing there, but really taking music into the community. And in fact, the South Bank show then followed me for a period of a month while I did this. And they made a television programme out of it that was very interesting, actually very moving, I felt, just showing how music can change people's lives and how you really don't have to have any previous experience of music, but you just need to throw away perhaps some preconceived ideas and perhaps a few thoughts about what you might be experiencing or what you ought to be experiencing and just have a bit more of an open mind. So that was really the gist of it. And I've also sort of continued this project really by trying to bang the drum for music education, which is terribly important to me. So I've now given two speeches in the House of Commons for MPs and for members of the Lords to talk about the importance of education really at the very, very start of the educational process, because, as I said earlier, I'm mindful of the fact that I wouldn't really be where I am today had it not been for the fact that at my state primary school these music lessons were offered. So I think it's incredibly important that generations are not missing out on these opportunities.
So Tasmin, yes, I mean, there we are. You started gigging in a tunnel under Waterloo Bridge, and you went on to even greater things, and now you're speaking to the powers that be about more education in schools. That's marvellous. We're going to finish up, if we may, with the Bach Partita, which is on the Naked Violin project.
Oh, I'm so glad you're going to play that. I really, really love that piece.
Good. Here it is. Thank you. Tasmin, thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really very, very grateful for you spending time to chat with us. And I hope the rest of your day goes extremely well. Are you off to do 8 hours of rehearsal and stuff?
Something like that, yes.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
really
my
much
pleasure.
Appreciated. And to you. Thank
okay,
you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.